night. This was not a day that Karen Reed was excited about. Well, maybe she is. I don't know. But I would think if you're at day one of your second murder trial, it is not that much fun. But here she was, arriving at court for day one of jury selection. Peer closely. See if you can see her smiling. Nope. But that changed. She did end up smiling. There you go. Because a whole lot of supporters were out front of that courthouse for her today, smiling, wearing pink, having placards, all the rest, saying, this is a conspiracy. That's what they think. The cops conspired to railroad that woman. And last time round, the jury was deadlocked. What about this time? The questionnaire alone made me think they're never going to get a jury. Guess how many they picked in a whole day. I will tell you that in just a moment. I couldn't believe it. Number two, Luigi Mangione. He may be smiling at all the love letters and money and all the rest his supporters are sending him at the federal lockup, but he just got a note he is not going to like. Not at all. Because it literally means the rest of his life could be horrendous. It also means the rest of his life could be very, very short. I will tell you what happened today in his case. And then Lori Vallow, if it is confusing to you, I get it. I get it. She's just a bad lady, right? We know that because she killed her two young children. She also conspired and killed the wife of the man she wanted to marry and did just weeks after burying that poor late wife. So we know that she is thrice convicted of murder and sentenced to life behind bars. But here she is. She's in court again on another murder. And it's not the last one. But this time, there's a reason to watch. In Idaho, she stayed quiet for the whole trial. She didn't take the stand. She barely spoke at all, except for when the judge, you know, asked, you know, is that your decision? You don't want to testify? That's right. This time, hell to the no, Lori Vallow is talking up a storm because Lori Vallow is also the lawyer. Lori chose herself as a lawyer, and she blew through jury selection in record pace. But what kind of jurors do you think she got? I've got all that because I got a front row seat there. Somebody who sat through the whole thing. Cameras weren't allowed on, but we've got the next best thing, a real person. And then in the House of Horrors in Connecticut, we are learning so much that's just so difficult to understand and disturbing all at the same time. That lady right there is facing a slew of charges after allegedly locking her son for more than two decades behind a padlock in a storage room upstairs in the house that she and her husband shared. This was her husband's kid. He said he was locked away from the age of 11. And when they found him, he was just 69 pounds. We heard the story, but now we're seeing it. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at these pictures, but this was what the inside of the house looked like. Granted, there was a fire there. He started the fire because he wanted to escape, but this was the evidence of the inside of the house after the fire. And as you can see, it was really, really awful. Tonight, you're going to hear from his sister. She's joining me to talk about their upbringings and how both of their upbringings were so incredibly different and what she thinks of the woman charged with doing this. Let's start here. 92 people had their morning routines completely upended today when they were commanded to appear in Norfolk County Superior Court in Massachusetts. And when they got there, they had to take a test. What do you know about Karen Reed? Most of the questions asked. It was a jury questionnaire that the prospective jurors had to fill out on day one of Karen Reed's second murder trial. Imagine being called for that jury duty. But right now, 90 of those 92 are either very, very relieved or oddly disappointed that they did not get picked. And honestly, both of those reactions are completely valid. After all, Reed's first jury deliberated for days before throwing up their hands and declaring they were deadlocked, unable to decide whether Reed killed her police officer boyfriend with her SUV on a snowy night back in January of 2022. So now, here we are. We're back at it again, with Reed facing charges of second-degree murder all over again, as well as manslaughter while under the influence of alcohol and leaving the scene of a personal injury and death. So how does Karen Reed herself feel about all of that?
I feel good. Excuse me, I'm eating chips.
You're all right. Feel good?
Yeah, I feel good.
Optimistic?
I always feel good. I always feel optimistic. Yep. I have faith. I have great support. I have great attorneys. I have the truth. I'm not afraid of anything, so I always feel good. I feel blessed.
You got to feel comfortable if you're eating chips on the way into court, right? Or out. Let's get right to News Nation national correspondent Caitlin Becker. She is live right now outside of that courthouse in Dedham, Massachusetts. Caitlin, normally when I go to a reporter outside of a courthouse, there's some fancy courthouse in the background, all nicely lit up. But there's a reason that we're going to in the location that you are, because you're basically showing me the treatment that all their supporters got today.
Ashley, this is where the Free Karen Reed supporters have to be. It's called a new buffer zone. I'm a couple hundred feet away from the courthouse. The city actually had these metal signs made and attached to light posts and signposts all around the courthouse so that protesters know they cannot go past this sign and get closer to the courthouse. I'm going to walk a little bit closer to it so you can see just how far away it is. Now, the reason they have to stay away, no signage, no bullhorns, no flags, is because the judge says he doesn't want the jury to be influenced. So there was a handful of them pretty pissed off, for lack of a better term, earlier today, that they were being pushed so far back. I mean, you're still walking with me towards the courthouse here, Ash, but we're still not even to where the jury had walked in, and there were barricades flanking these streets earlier today. A bunch of them are still up, and I'll get you closer to them in a little bit, but they were pushed pretty far away, hundreds and hundreds of feet. And they say they're peacefully protesting, but I don't even think Karen Reed could have heard them when I saw her walking in and out of that courthouse today.
I keep thinking you're going to trip as you're walking backwards, but you are really, really good at that, Caitlin. And thank you for showing me. I didn't actually realize how far back they'd been pushed this time round. In all the pictures and video that everybody's seen in the Karen Reed documentary from round one, they were right there. They were there. They were yelling and screaming and cheering for her. She was walking by almost high-fiving them last time round. So very different feel and look this time. So here's the big thing. The jury questionnaire that I read last night, because we got our hands on it early, was so amazing. It covered everything. Like, I don't even know what else you could have covered in life other than do you like puppies or kitties. But they only picked 2 out of 92, and that pace seems really, really, really slow to me. How do they feel about this?
Really slow. Yeah, it feels really slow. The judge and the lawyers are anticipating that this is going to take a couple of weeks. And Ashley, in addition to only 2 of them being picked, 78 out of those 92 said that they were familiar with Karen Reed in the trial. But the most important question, I think, for both sides here and the judge is whether or not they had already formulated an opinion about this case and about this trial. And a handful of them said that they had. So they had to be immediately dismissed. A couple of the other questions on that questionnaire that you mentioned had to do with law enforcement, because as we all well know from the first time around, there are going to be a ton of officers taking the stand. So they want to know from these prospective jurors, about 1,200 of them, I was told, are going to be polled between now and the beginning of trial. They want to know if they are likely to trust an officer on the stand just because they are an officer, or likely to distrust an officer on the stand just because they are an officer. So it's going to be a long road, Ash.
Speaking of that, it's been a long road since her last trial. Can you just set the stage for me on what happened last time?
Yeah, it comes down to really 2 questions. Did Karen Reed mow down her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, with her Lexus in a driveway on a blizzardy night and then leave him for dead in the cold? Or is she being framed in a conspiracy by corrupt cops? Last time around, jurors could not decide.
9 weeks of testimony, 74 witnesses, and more than 650 exhibits. The jury deadlocked after 4 days of deliberation.
I'm declaring a mistrial in this case.
So what really happened that frigid January night? Things appeared to have started out just fine. Karen Reed and her boyfriend, Officer John O'Keefe, spent a night bar hopping with friends. CCTV footage showing the group tossing back drink after drink after drink after drink. The fun then moving to an after party at the home of fellow officer Brian Albert. And it's here that things get messy. The prosecution theory is simple. Karen and John were going through a rough patch. They argued, and when Karen dropped him off, she did a three-point turn out of the driveway, ran him over, and left him for dead in a blizzard. The defense, on the other hand, says the couple parted ways in the driveway just fine, but that something happened inside the house, an altercation at the party where O'Keefe was beaten and then callously tossed into the snow. It was Karen who would find him the next morning, battered, bruised, and frozen in the yard. O'Keefe's cause of death, hypothermia and blunt force trauma.
Free Karen! Free Karen! Free Karen!
Karen's defense team and her very vocal supporters claim that she's being framed, a victim of rampant corruption within the police department. Bits of a broken cocktail glass and shards from a busted taillight were found at the crime scene. Investigators, believing that taillight broke off of Reed's Lexus when she backed over her boyfriend. Reed's team claiming it was planted by crooked cops protecting their own. The lead investigator on the case, State Trooper Michael Proctor, found himself in hot water on the stand for texting offensive comments about his prime suspect.
From all accounts, he didn't do anything wrong. She's a whack job. See you in.
A disciplinary board recently kicked him off the force for good. And then there's the Google search done by Jennifer McCabe. Now, she was inside the party that night and the last person to text with O'Keefe. Her search, asking how long it takes to die in the cold. But when she made that inquiry, before or after he was found dead, depends on who you ask.
Ash, these barricades are all around the courthouse trying to make sure that no one is going to get close to Karen Reed this time around. This is where I saw her, all smiles, coming in and out of court today. But they even have caution tape up and down here so the media and the press can't get around. But as of tomorrow morning, we are back in jury selection and another roughly 100 people are going to be interviewed in voir dire tomorrow, Ashley.
Fantastic job at taking me to the location and taking me back in time. Caitlin Becker, thank you so much. I look forward to your next report. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ash.
Caitlin joining us live tonight. Now I want to bring in Joe Tacopina, longtime defense attorney, friend of the show, friend of mine, very good at his job. Okay, Joey Tack, here's the deal. I'm going to list off all the things in this case that are the same. Same judge. Same courtroom, same defendant, same prosecutors, same evidence, same accusations, same denials. And here are the two things that are different, the jury and maybe the outcome. What are your thoughts about this second round?
My thoughts are that it's a new trial. You have 12 new people who will decide it. But I think, you know, when you have a case like this, where the defense has had the advantage of seeing the prosecution's entire case, could go through a dry run, if you will. And to also have the prosecution's chief investigator implode and since been fired, I think the advantage goes drastically to the defense at this point. You know, but you are going to have 12 new people listen to this evidence anew. It doesn't matter what 12 other people thought. It's going to matter what these 12 people thought. But based on what I know about the case, look, I just don't see how you convict beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the standard. Remember, you know, Ashley, we all talk about did she do it, did she not do it? It's not she probably did it. It's not it's likely she did it. It's not I'm almost certain she did it. In a criminal case, the standard is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's there is no reason to doubt she did it. You could almost be certain she did it. That's not guilty. Okay. And people have to remember that. And Alan Jackson is very good at what he does. And Alan's a friend of mine and I know him well. And he is, he's going to make sure that that reasonable doubt charge is before that jury and inside of that deliberation room, because that's what this case is going to rise and fall on.
Well, you know, Netflix just released a really good docuseries on her just within the last few weeks. And there's just been so much media. The jury form alone, the questionnaire, was almost a full page of how much do you know about Karen and the media and the case and TikTok and all the rest. And I just wondered, how are you going to find a jury when you have almost precluded every factor of society? Do you have any issue with cops one way or the other? Do you have an issue with drinking and driving? Do you have an issue with domestic violence? Do you have an issue with the media? Do you have an issue with this lady? Do you have an issue with being in a public event? All these things. It's like, how on earth can you find someone that can be fair and impartial and click the right boxes?
Well, you know, you're not going to find someone who knows nothing about this case, especially from that community. If you do, you're finding a liar. But what you want to find is someone who says, yeah, I've read the media about this, or I've heard about it. I know cops. I know, you know, people who had experiences with cops. But can I put it all aside and listen to the evidence fairly and objectively, receive the laws the judge gives it to me, and listen to the facts without bias? Can I do that? I can do that. There are jurors who can do that. There are people who can do that. That's what we do in jury selection. The problem with jury selection in this courtroom and in this state, it's archaic. Ashley, it's archaic. The reason why we have two jurors so far out of 96 is because it's an archaic system. The defense filed motions for a panel voir dire here. And voir dire is the jury selection process for right. It means to speak the truth. So when you get to question jurors here, this jury system that they do in Massachusetts is you questioning one juror at a time. One juror at a time, not in a panel, where normally the jury box is filled, and you're questioning the jurors, and you're seeing how they interact with each other, and you're letting them speak, sometimes to each other, sometimes answering questions. There's a synergy that you're picking up. That's part of the jury selection process. Here, you're speaking to one juror at a sidebar, out of the presence of everyone else, and you're being allowed to ask four or five questions as a defense attorney. That is insufficient. It's basically like reading tea leaves, and you just don't know. I know the questionnaire is thorough, but a questionnaire, you know, people could fill out, you know, yes, no, whatever. It's different than when you hear the spoken word, how they speak and how they say things, and you get to follow up with questions. When you're allowed four or five questions, and it's done at a sidebar in a very sort of artificial setting, it's not really, really that good.
Let me switch gears and get you to put on another hat for a second, although I very much like the one you're wearing. But the Pam Bondi decision today, the Attorney General suggesting to the DOJ that she would like the DOJ to go after the death penalty for Luigi Mangione, the young, handsome man who is up on charges of executing a healthcare executive on the streets of New York City. First of all, that is a very big deal when you seek the death penalty in a federal murder case. Secondly, does anybody think that you can find a jury that will all be okay with that, given the unbelievable groundswell of support that he's had?
Well, let's start with the first one. It is a big deal, but this is a new administration. President Trump and Pam Bondi, who I've known for two decades, and Pam's a terrific lawyer, and she's going to follow what she believes the law is. And the law allows for there to be a federal death penalty, assuming the administration wants to apply, which clearly they do, when there's murder through the use of a firearm and commission of crimes of violence. And here, there is a crime of violence and commission of firearms use. And here, they're saying there was a political bent here. And clearly there was. It was a, you know, anti-corporate America, anti-health insurance bent. So you have the ability to seek a federal death penalty. So that's one. They're within their rights, and Pam Bondi certainly has the ability to do it, and is going to be approved. I have no doubt about that. Will they ever get it is the next question. I think that's and Ashley, here's why. Look, it's probably very unlikely. I don't think because he's cute. First of all, I don't even think he's cute. But I mean, putting that aside, I don't ever look at a murderer, a cowardly murderer, as cute. Okay, this guy is a murderer. He murdered a guy from behind in cold blood with two kids and a wife, basically in the Christmas season, and then ran like a little coward. You're a tough guy. You want to be a hero to the people. Stand there, murder him, and say why you did it. But murdering someone, shooting them from behind in the back, and then running away is not really making someone a hero. But this guy has been hero worshipped by people in his most repulsively unintelligent fashion. Okay. And I think those people, and the sick part of this, Ashley, is a lot of these people come from Ivy League schools. And they have this justification. If that's the case, we should go murder CEOs of Pfizer. I mean, why would we hit all the pharma, big pharma, you know, CEOs? And they, you know, this guy's only United Healthcare. There's other insurance companies. I mean, why should we start whacking all the CEOs of corporate America who we disagree with their policies on? I mean, literally, that's what this guy did. That being said, it is not a mass murder. It's not a mass shooting. It's not an act of terrorism.
Right.
It's a horrible crime. It's a horrible crime. But as serious as it is, it doesn't fit the rubric of someone who should be put to death traditionally.
Sure.
So it's not because he thinks he's cute or he's got curly hair, wears, you know, box-sider shoes or something. I don't think anyone cares about that. Because the evidence didn't come in that he murdered an innocent man with two children and a wife.
So,
I think the
I'm going to put on the defense attorney hat for a second, and I'm going to say, you make an amazing argument, but you, here I go. But he is innocent until proven guilty, of course. And he will get his day in court. And you, my friend, have to come back and talk to me again because I love our conversations, Joey Tack. Thank you for this.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ash.
All right, Joey Tacopina joining me again on this program. Lucky me. All right, coming up, two kids who share a mother and precious little else. One grew up in the world of white picket fences, stories at bedtime, and the other was a prisoner in a house of horrors, weighing just 69 pounds when he was rescued at age 32. You have heard the prisoner's story, but tonight you'll see the pictures. The man's sister joins me live next.
Thanks for listening to News Nation on the go. I'm Connell McShane, and this is America's fastest growing cable news network, delivering fact-based, unbiased news from all sides.
The last time Heather Tessman saw her half-brother, she was a small child and he was an infant. When she grew up, she tried to find him but couldn't. But a month and a half ago, she did find him on the news after he'd set fire to the Connecticut house where he had grown up and was trying to escape. He told responders that he had been a virtual prisoner in that house since the age of 11, and that for all of those 21 years, he had lived in torment. His sister learned from those news reports that now at the age of 32, her half-brother weighed just 69 pounds when the firefighters rescued him. The victim and his sister, Heather, share the same mother, a mother who gave up custody of both of them soon after they were born. Heather went into foster care and was later adopted, living the kind of life that her birth mom could not give her, a normal life. Her brother, however, had a very different upbringing. He was raised, if that's what you can call it, by his biological father and that man's wife, Kimberly Sullivan, the defendant. He and his sister Heather grew up just 15 minutes away from each other, but light years apart in every other sense. We have known for weeks about the unspeakable cruelty that brother says he endured every minute of every day in a house of horrors with his father and stepmother, but now we can actually see inside. Police in Waterbury, Connecticut have just released photos of that home, and they are as vile as we expected. Keep in mind, these pictures were taken after the victim set fire to the house in order to escape, and firefighters tried to knock that fire down. So you will see smoke damage, but that does not account for everything else you'll see. Certainly not for the filth and the locks that were fastened on the outside of doors. Kimberly Sullivan is now charged with assault, kidnapping, unlawful restraint, reckless endangerment, and cruelty to persons. And her attorney is none too pleased that these photos are making the rounds.
It was shocking, to say the least. I can't explain why it would be done. The only thing that we could think of is that it's clearly being done to sway public opinion. In 2005, the police went to the home. They spoke to the individual. They reported that he appeared healthy and happy, and that the residence appeared normal and lived in.
Happy and healthy. 20 years ago. That is the best they can do? That lawyer's client is out on $300,000 bail, and my next guest thinks that that is an outrage. Heather Tessman joins me now, half-sister of the 69-pound man identified only in court papers as male victim one. Heather, thank you so much for being on tonight to talk about this. What were your first thoughts when you heard the news about the fire and the rescue and the condition of your brother?
Well, I had first heard about what was going on via, you know, like body cam footage on YouTube and all that. It was days later when our mom had gotten a hold of me and said, "Hey, we found your brother." It was this guy. And I was like, absolutely not. There's no way. There's no way. You just never in your wildest dreams or worst nightmare could ever even think that this would be a possibility of somebody you've been actively searching for forever.
Talk to me about that, Heather. You had tried to find him and you had reached out in the past. What was the reaction of your brother's family to your efforts to see him and to meet him and to engage as a sibling?
I was pretty much told to go away and he wasn't there. So, you know, as far as I was aware, he was out of high school, hopefully, and, you know, living his own life away from these people.
But you were blocked.
That's all I know. Huh?
You were blocked. They effectively said, no, no comment, no connection, be on your way.
Yeah, exactly. And if you get that direct, what are you supposed to do? There was nothing
now,
to find.
Now that you know this is what his life has been all these years you grew up apart, have you had any luck in trying to reconnect as he tries to heal from what he's been through?
I have not had any luck, but it's not up to me at this point. It's up to him 100%. I would love a relationship, but if he doesn't want that, I have to deal with that in my own time. But I've always wanted him, really.
Have the detectives in this case been helpful to you at all, informing you of anything that's been going on in the investigation going forward?
No. It's an active investigation, and I understand I haven't exactly been vetted, but it's like I said, not up to me.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the pictures that we're all seeing. I know what my reaction is, but he's not my brother living in these conditions. What was your reaction?
I was horrified. I had a house fire when I was younger, so I understand what like regular house fire damage looks like. And it's a pigsty and very unhygienic. I'm horrified. I really am. It's what like a house you go to an urban explorer in after it's been abandoned for 20 years looks like, not a lived-in house.
And then there are the locks that we can see on the outside of doors. It must be harrowing to know that that could be the circumstance he was looking at for two decades.
It's inhumane. There's no reason for it. I don't care how he was as a little kid. Nobody deserves locks on the outside of the doors. It's just subhuman.
Heather, I hope that you can reconnect with your brother at some point when he's well. I hope that there's some healing, certainly for him as well. And I wish you peace in your family. This has just been such a difficult story to report. And again, I'm not living it. So thank you for talking and sharing your story tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Heather Tessman joining us tonight. Coming up after the break, Lori Vallow's new best friends, or her new worst enemies, depending on what they think of her during their deliberations in her murder trial. The Doomsday Cult Mom has finished round one, picking an Arizona jury while representing herself in court. So, who are these folks with a front row seat to Lori the lawyer? Full report next.
You're listening to Banfield on News Nation's audio stream. Available 24/7 on the News Nation app, or just say, Alexa, play News Nation.
What a milestone tonight for Lori Vallow. She just did something in 2 days that most counselors might take weeks to do. She picked a jury while acting as her own lawyer for her own murder trial. I know she already had a murder trial, but that was Idaho. And this is Arizona. And a whole new victim that police say she murdered. Husband number 4 out of a total of 5. So now 12 jurors and 4 alternates are going to decide if back in 2019 she plotted and directed the murder of Charles Vallow. Opening statements are on track to start on Monday and testimony is expected to last 5 to 6 weeks. So cameras weren't allowed inside the courtroom for the jury selection, but we have the next best thing, a trusted friend who was there, front row seat to everything. Lauren Mathias is a journalist and a co-host of the very popular Hidden True Crime podcast. Okay, Lauren, fast can be good, but fast can be bad. What was your take on the whole jury selection process?
It was certainly fast. It was fast. You know, I want to say what's interesting about this jury too, Ashley, I have to say, is there are only three females out of 16. So 12 jurors, four alternate, only three females. That's also interesting, right? I mean, you've got a victim that's a male. So that's something. But you also have Lori, who I think likes to try to manipulate men. That's in her background. So I find this makeup kind of really interesting.
Did she ask the right questions? Did anybody sort of gossip or chatter in the gallery saying, oh dear, she kind of missed on that one?
You know, the judge had to help her. She kept trying. She actually said at one point that your job to these potential jurors sitting here is to protect me from the state, to protect her. And let me tell you who the state is: the judge, the prosecutor, and pretty much everyone in this courtroom except for me and my team. You need to protect me from them. There was an objection, and then the judge explained, jurors, your job is not to protect her. It is to make sure that the state meets our burden of proof. But that was a really interesting moment if you want to get into her mindset of what she's thinking that she needs this jury to do to protect her. You know, she needed some help. Go ahead, Ashley.
Well, I was going to say, she better watch it, because you say things like that and you could be treading on a mistrial. And maybe that's what she wants. Maybe she actually wants to play games and have, you know, side trips out of her cell where she gets to wear nice clothes and do her hair and be a lawyer. And damn the mistrial. Who cares? I get another shot at it after that. Who knows what her mind is. But what is interesting today is that she is appearing in plain clothes. Right? She gets to wear what she wants. She doesn't wear handcuffs or leg irons, but it doesn't mean they don't have control of her as an inmate. How are they controlling her as an inmate?
She has what is called a rack belt on, RACC, and it is essentially a stun belt. And she is not happy about this. Let me say that too. She made a big fuss about it in court yesterday. Why do I have to wear this? You said I didn't have to wear this. And the judge is like, no, I said you didn't have to wear the leg restraint, but I'm making sure you said you're going to wear this. She fought it and fought it, but she is in a stun belt.
Well, that won't make her waistline look the way she wants it, I suppose.
No, but it won't.
They can't see it. It's under her clothes. Okay. She should be so lucky, you know, that she doesn't have to wear the handcuffs into her job. So the next question I have is supporters. Does Lori have anybody there for her?
No, she does have Sue. Well, it's not her. Her cousin, her first cousin, Megan Connor, is in the gallery, but I wouldn't say that Megan is necessarily there for her. Megan is there to, I think, process what has happened to her family. I don't think she's not against her cousin necessarily, but she's not saying, I am showing up to give her the love and support she needs. She's there on her own.
Well, I know that Charles Vallow's sister, Kay, and Kay's husband, Larry, plan to be a part of this process no matter what. They have a very vested interest in what happened to Charles Vallow, and I always pray for them. It's such a hard process. Lauren, thank you for doing this. Thank you for being our eyes and ears. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ash.
Again, Lauren Mathias's podcast is Hidden True Crime. Check it out if you haven't already. Still ahead tonight, a controversial New Jersey mayor is facing calls to step down. And no, I am not suddenly covering politics here. I am still covering true crime. And Mayor Gina LaPlaca is accused of a serious one. See if you can tell what she's been charged with as you watch her removing her toddler from his car seat after a pickup from daycare.
Are you okay?
Yes, I am. Welcome to the house, buddy.
You all right?
Yes, I am.
I'm struggling to stand a little bit.
All good, thank you.
You okay?
Yes, I am.
All right,
thank
you. Sure? Have you had anything to drink or anything like that?
No, I'm good.
Three guesses, and I'll bet you don't need the first two. I've got the full body cam of what happened here coming up next.
Bill O'Reilly on Cuomo.
Number one.
You're a cheap frump.
America's favorite sparring duo with TV's liveliest, most honest debate.
You have a tie on that goes with nothing else.
Tomorrow at 8, 7 Central, only on News Nation.
Chris, I enjoy your show. While we may agree or disagree, we're never disagreeable, and I appreciate your points.
This is the place that respects all Americans.
Congressman, you're always welcome here.
News Nation, news for all Americans.
I know this is April Fool's Day, but I want to talk about St. Patrick's Day for a minute, which is ancient history for most of us, whether it was good, bad, or ugly. But for some of us, it was really ugly, and it won't be forgotten anytime soon. And I'm looking at you, Gina LaPlaca. Gina is the mayor of Lumberton Township, New Jersey, just east of Philadelphia. At least she is the mayor for now. But the public demand for her to quit or be fired is likely to pick up in the wake of this newly released body cam video of her arrest on March 17th, St. Patty's Day, for allegedly driving drunk with her two-year-old son in the car. Lumberton police met up with her honor, in her driveway after they got multiple calls about a blue BMW swerving through traffic, running up on the grass, blowing a red light, and almost hitting another car and utility pole. And here's how the visit from the cops played out.
Are you okay?
Yes, I am. Over the house, buddy.
You all right?
Yes, I am.
I'm struggling to stand a little bit.
Oh, good. Thank you.
You okay?
Yes, I am.
All right.
Thank you.
Sure. Have you had anything to drink or anything like that?
No, I'm good.
We got lots of calls where we had multiple calls.
Oh, really?
That you ran a red light and you were swerving.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What happened to me? Your mirror here.
Here, come here. That's not good.
What happened? Was it like this?
Yeah, that's a...
What about this one? Did you hit something on the way here?
Yeah.
What'd you hit? Where at?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? Where you come from?
From school.
Have you had anything to drink?
Yeah.
Where at? It's all right. I mean, luckily you're not hurt or anything like that.
No. No.
All right. So, would you mind doing some tests for it?
Sorry.
It's okay. Okay. Did you hit 9 yet? No, it's okay. You want to take 9 steps coming back? It's okay. The next test we're going to do is the one leg stand, okay?
Okay.
What you're going to do is you're going to stand with your hands at your side,
okay.
Your feet together just like you do now. Don't start the test until I tell you to do so.
Okay.
Don't start until I tell you to do so. What you're going to do is you're going to lift any foot of your choice up approximately 6 inches off the ground, okay? You're going to keep your foot parallel to the ground. I don't know if this is urine or...
Yeah. Okay. That's it right there.
Oh, that's alcohol?
Mm-hmm.
She said she drank vodka, so...
Yeah, that's much for something.
Yeah, how much have you had to drink today?
I don't know.
All right. What did you drink?
I did vodka.
Okay.
Sorry.
We're just doing our job, so...
No, I know you are.
All right, so, like, this time we have to place you under arrest for driving while intoxicated.
Okay.
Also passed me.
What's it?
Just step back.
Hey,
I know, that's okay.
Police took the mayor in for booking, but then had to take her to the hospital because her blood alcohol level was so high. And this isn't LaPlaca's first run-in with the law. Back in 2023, while deputy mayor, she was reportedly arrested for allegedly assaulting her husband. But he took the blame and the charges were dropped. And now he's defending her again. On Facebook, he called the latest arrest LaPlaca's rock bottom and says that she's finally getting the help that she needs. But not all of her constituents are willing to wait. In a township meeting last week after the arrest, but before the video came out, several residents and at least one committee member said LaPlaca needs to go. But legally, she doesn't have to. And she is reportedly telling her critics, in effect, make me. She's due to face a judge in 2 weeks on charges of driving under the influence, reckless driving, and endangering the welfare of a child. We will keep you posted. An update now on a picture that I showed you yesterday. Virginia Roberts Giuffre, the Jeffrey Epstein accuser who brought down Prince Andrew and Ghislaine Maxwell. She posted this picture on social media saying she had only 4 days left to live after a bus crash. But now there is a different story coming out. And we've got it. And it's next.
Thanks for listening to News Nation On The Go. I'm Leland Vittert. This is America's fastest-growing cable news network, delivering fact-based, unbiased news from all sides.
As you may have seen online or on this show last night, the woman best known for helping bring down Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and Prince Andrew, claimed on social media that she had just 4 days to live. Virginia Giuffre said that she'd gone into kidney failure after an accident between her car and a school bus. Well, tonight we know the accident did really happen, but police in the very rural part of Australia where Giuffre lives tells the New York Post that no injuries were reported at the time of the crash and that the wreck was so minor that the bus driver waited until the next day to report it officially. So now there is an updated statement from Giuffre's spokeswoman, which reads in part, Virginia was banged up and bruised and returned home. Virginia's condition worsened and she was admitted to the hospital. Concerning her Instagram post, Virginia thought that she had posted it on her private Facebook page. There is no mention in the statement of 4 days to live, nor of what Giuffre's supposed condition really is, but watch this space. We will report when we find out. In the meantime, check out my podcast, Drop Dead Serious. I've got a full analysis of all the questions on the questionnaire for the Karen Reed jurors that they got this morning, and a look at Lori Vallow sparring with the judge. Two different bonus episodes. Check it out. There's the QR code, or you can just go to dropdeadserious.com, and you will find everything there. Thanks for watching, everyone, tonight. Nice to have you here. We'll be back again tomorrow night.